from the World Wide Web, welcome to Phantom Radio, presented by The Cagle Company. Well, Phantom fans, this week's special guest has been a friend of mine for over four decades. He's a very unique individual because of the variety of areas that he is an expert in. For example, as a junior bowler in the late 70s, he was a Greater LA Junior All-Star, a competitive PBA member for about 16 years, a pro shop operator from 1996 to 2000. He ran the USBC ABC Storm Booth at the National Stadium in 95. He was a director of pro shop operations at Coast Properties from 2000 to 2003. He worked for Brunswick as a West Coast product specialist from 2003 to 2008, and now he works for Steve Cook's Bowling Supply as an account sales manager. He also finds time to be a 900 Global Tour rep and has co-written, published two books, Head Games, Sports Mental Game book, and the R-E-Volve Drilling Technical Manual. He's also involved currently with Instructional Foundation New Fusion Bowling. So, Phantom fans, here's a very busy Rick Hamlin. Hello, Rick. Welcome back to the show, buddy.
Good morning, Phantom. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, it's the holidays, and I got turkey dressing all over my shirt, but I love it, man. My favorite holiday.
Yeah? Did you have a good one?
Yeah, I really did, Parts. I went over to my old buddy Nick Melnikoff's, and they had about 35 people there. It was an unbelievable amount of food. There was like six pies. I didn't know which one to take one out of, so I took one of each. It was great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the one day that we always overdo it, don't we?
Oh, for sure.
I was going to say, you know, it's funny. You were talking about, you know, my drilling experience and whatnot, and I was talking to somebody the other day, and they, you know, I retired in 01 from the bowling side of it, and somebody said, was that, you know, primarily your injuries and whatnot? I said, some of it was. I said, but some of it, like today, I'm having a lot of problems with my right hip, and a lot of that was from drilling. And a lot of people don't realize the stress you put on your body when you're drilling versus as much as when you're bowling.
Oh,
so
man.
You got to feel. Yeah. We got to feel for pro shop operators.
For sure, you know, you're lifting up that ball, you're rotating it, you're putting it back down, you're doing a dusting on the holes and the whole bit. It's unbelievable. It's a lot of hard work, no question.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm ready when you are.
All right, Pards. Well, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to be here with us again on Phantom Radio. And we had a lot of response from the last time you were here because you were here last month and I told you that I'd have you back again because you turned the tables on me and you said you had some more questions, but are you going to do the same thing to me this month?
Yep, I got a few more questions for you that we didn't get to last month.
Oh, God, okay, well, go ahead if you insist.
We left off kind of with doing a little bit of the history of the PBA, which you're very, you were part of the foundation in that and very fundamental with it. So, in your mind, if I was to ask you who was your favorite top five, who would it be?
Oh, brother, you know, I've been asked this question before, and it's very difficult, but, you know, the way I answered it the last time, which was years ago, it's so tough because there were different eras. You know, we had the 60s with basically rubber balls and lacquer lane finishes. Then we had the 70s. We had plastic balls, and we started having some hard finishes, you know, urethane lane finishes. Then in the 80s, you know, we had the synthetics, and we had urethane bowling ball. So there are three different eras and actually, you know, three totally different ball reactions and different types of players. So what I've done is in the past, I've broken it down by saying my top five in the 60s were Dick Weber, Dave Davis, Harry Smith, Billy Hardwick, and Dave Sutar. And then in the 70s, I got Don Johnson, Mark Roth, Marshall Holman, Dick Ritker, and Earl Anthony. And then in the 80s, we got Wayne Webb, Mike Albee, Mark Roth, Nelson Burton Jr., and Earl Anthony again. So that's basically what I've got it broken down to.
So if you were going to say today who would be your top five just from watching, because I know you're not involved as much as you were before, but if you know, who was your top five today of the guys that are competing?
Oh, boy. You know what? I've cut this off on the 80s because when the 90s came with resin and all synthetic lanes and all these different styles, to be honest with you, I've kind of lost track. And
yeah.
I don't know what's going on. If somebody came to me that throws the ball like they do nowadays, and I used to be able to tell a guy what he was doing wrong. Now I have no idea what's going on because there's two-handers, there's three-handers, there's guys sort of behind their back, there's, you know, they're walking sideways. I have no idea what's going on, and I admit the game has passed me by, Pards.
Okay, that's a good response. And being in the coaching side of it, it has definitely gotten, I'm not going to say more difficult, but it's a lot more technical.
It is, I'm telling you. It's unreal.
Okay, so let's move on to the second question. Now, going back to your era, 60s, 70s, and 80s, And I've talked to a lot of the competitive guys from that era. Who would you say was either the most clutch or the top two or three clutch?
Oh, boy. Okay, clutch performers. You know, as far as clutch performers goes, you can actually pick any one of those guys I mentioned before. But I got to tell you, if I needed one guy to throw one strike for me for my life, it would be a choice of two guys, and it's a tie between Dave Ferraro and Tony Westlake.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I watched those guys for years, and, you know, there's different horses for different courses, and some guys are good qualifiers, some guys are good in the finals, and some guys are good in the 10th frame. And both of these guys, when they had a chance to win, they won because they stuffed it right. They stuffed it in the hole when they needed it. Unbelievable.
Tony Westlake had a great quote. They asked him what he would be doing if he wasn't bowling anymore. He said a drag racer. He goes, because I could sit down and go somewhere really fast. And I always remember that one. So, but, you know, I remember I was traveling with Johnny Petraglia years ago, and we were talking about that. And I asked him, you know, because he competed against these guys. And, you know, he said Earl wasn't that clutch because Earl had most of his titles locked up by the 5th, 6th, and 7th frames. So he didn't have to be.
Wow.
He goes, but in his opinion, it was either Don Johnson or Mark Roth.
Good point, yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, when you start talking about that, that's awesome. That's a different perspective that I would have never thought about. But you're right. I you know, going back, because I competed a little bit against Ferraro and Westlake, and both those guys were definitely pretty clutch. They did get the most out of whatever.
It's amazing, yeah. They could throw it in the hole when they needed it. Amazing.
Yeah, that is. You know, Parker was pretty good. I did a couple of exhibitions with him on some difficult conditions, and I saw him able to throw some shots on some conditions where you would have never thought that he could hit the head pin, more or less strike. So,
yeah, well, you know me, I'm kind of fair and equitable.
Yeah.
I had to stick only one lefty in there, and that had to be Earl. So Parker, there's no question, Parker was unreal. And same was with Mike Albee.
I would agree with that because there's times that I saw them competing where, you know, I'd walk down and they'd sit there and talk to you about lunch or the weather or whatever, and then they'd go up and throw a shot like it was for their life. And I was always impressed with that because that's a different kind of a different breed right there. So,
yeah, for sure.
All right, next question. You're going to like this one. Give me some of your favorite nicknames of some of the guys you worked with or were out competing at the time.
You know, that's kind of like a thing with guys, you know. Guys tease each other because they don't like to say I love you because it's kind of feminine to say that. So what they do is they give their good buddies nicknames and all that. But some of these guys had famous nicknames, and I love nicknames, but like Holman the Pullman. Marshall Holman,
yep.
And then the gods, Jim Godman. There was nothing like the gods. And then this one here is probably the most dynamic, the Doomsday Striking Machine.
That was Earl, was it not?
Earl Anthony, yeah. Yep. I researched that, and it's two different things, actually. One says he was the Doomsday Striking Machine, and the other book that I was reading said that Doomsday Stroking Machine. So either one, unreal.
Yeah, I remember Soupy was Sutar, Rags was Petraglia.
Yep.
But yeah, you know, it's kind of like talking to Larry Lichtenstein.
Yeah.
Everybody was Pards or Hoff.
Yeah. How about, I'll give you a little quick test. Who was the Green Machine?
Wayne Webb.
Good. Who was the Sphinx?
Oh, that one, I don't know.
Roy Buckley.
Oh, yeah, I should have known that one. You're right, yes.
Yep, okay.
That's true.
Okay, one more. Who is the Mouth of the South?
Couture?
No, this guy, you couldn't shut him up.
Oh, he passed away.
No. Not yet.
Then you got me on that one.
George Pappas.
Oh, okay. No, I was, remember, oh, gosh, now you're going to make me think. He was from down in the Louisiana area. He died from brain tumor or brain cancer?
Jimmy Certain?
Yes, Certain. That's who I was trying to think of, was Jimmy Certain.
Okay, yeah.
But Pappas, yeah, that's true. I remember you telling me some funny stories about him. That's
all right, you'll know this one. Who was the lobster?
Yes, Larry Lobb. He's still living up in this area in Bowling League up in the Sacramento area.
All right, if you don't know this, you're fired. Who was the Cookie Monster?
Yes, that was Steve Cook. the big man.
That's your boss. But one of my favorites was, and you even mentioned it, Larry Lichtenstein. Larry gave this guy this nickname, Cyclops.
Yeah, that one I don't think I know.
Yeah, it was Ernie Schlegel, because he only had one eye, you know.
Yeah. You know, you told me the funniest story about Schlegel. We were talking one time, and you said, wherever you finish a conversation with him, he'll pick it up the next time you see him.
Oh, yeah, it could be four years later.
Oh, so I was talking to him one time. We were talking about something when I was with Brunswick, and I didn't see him for literally a month, 6 weeks, and I run into him in an elevator at a hotel at a tournament, and I swear to you, he started the conversation right where we left off, and all I could think of was you.
Yeah, he is amazing.
Yes, he is. Okay.
Right, what else you got?
You know, over the years, you've given me some really good advice. Barry Asher's given me some great advice. Talking to Steve a little bit. There's always been guys that you pick, you know, bits and pieces out. And when I coach individuals, I always tell them, look, we're going to try something. This might not work. It might not work now. It might work later in your game at another point. But what's the best advice somebody's ever offered you or given you or that you've heard of?
Okay, good. You know, I've given, 800 interviews on this show, and I've asked a million questions of all the top players. And, you know, there's a lot of formulations of as far as your style goes, and it's like a formula for success. You know, a good knee bend, keep your head still, tuck your elbow in. There's all kind of those fundamentals. But the number one thing that most every pro says, make your spares.
Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of come up that it's almost become a lost art with the way the game has changed.
I know it. I watched a show about 3 weeks ago. They missed three spares in a row. I'm telling you, my cat even jumped off the couch.
Yeah, well, you made a great comment. We were somewhere, and there was a guy in the squad. I don't know if I've ever told this story on the show or not, but the squad was running late, and this guy missed a 10-pin, and you go, you know, it's so bad you can't even root for the ball once it's off his hand. And you told him jokingly, you said, hey, save us some time. You know, if you leave anything, just push it off so we can get going.
Wow.
And I always laugh, but you're right. It just seems like, you know, in today's game, that spares are a lost art.
It's amazing. Yep.
You know, that is good. That's, it's funny when I work with people, that is still something that I try to work with them on, is telling them, you know, every open's at least 11 pins.
Sure. You need a double to make up for it.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. In your years of doing the lanes out on the PBA tour and everywhere else, what is the one tournament center surface that you're the proudest of? If you were going to pick one, if somebody put a gun to your head and said, what's your bet, what are you the proudest for, which could you name it?
Yeah, I really could. You know, it's kind of like the one that we always looked up to. This is where you've got to duplicate this every chance we get, because first of all, number one, our main priority was to try to make the lanes fair left to right, and if they were fair left to right, then it was squad to squad. Which squad had an advantage? And then if we got that right, then the guys would be looking at the scoreboard telling us about the strokers have an advantage this week, or the straight players have an advantage this week, or they're different today than they were yesterday. I mean, you look at that scoreboard for 4 days in a row, and you'll find something wrong, and they always came to tell us because nobody wanted to call their wife back home and say they bowled bad.
Right.
They wanted to blame us, you know. So
right.
We had a lot of priorities. But one year at the Brunswick World Open, it was in 1989, and we came upon a surface they had recoated three times in the last 3 months to get the best possible surface. And Rick Barbera, you know Rick, right?
Yes, yep.
He ran that bowling center. We were in touch with him morning, noon, and night for 3 months. We went in there, and that place glistened. I mean, it was beautiful. That tournament, I got to tell you, we kept track. It had 192 players. The field was cut after 3 days to the top 64, and there was 21 off A squad, 21 off of B squad,
wow,
and 22 off of C squad. And the scores stayed within three pins each day,
wow,
which was a miracle because usually the scores will vary based on how
right,
the guys play the lanes. And as it turned out, there was eight guys off each squad that made the top 24. There was eight straight players, eight strokers, and eight power players in there. And there were four lefties in the top 24, which was about the right formula.
Ratio.
Yeah, right ratio. And you know what? There was not one complaint all week. In fact, I would say that stuck around the bowling alley morning, noon, and night, waiting for somebody to say nice job. I'm still waiting, but at least we didn't get anybody complaining. And that
right,
was unbelievable, the greatest tournament of all time.
I remember when I was still out competing, I remember you talking about how you would adjust when you were spray gunning them, how you would adjust so that the amount of volume that was on the lane when we started on Wednesday was comparable when we started, you know, if we bowled match play, if we made it to match play, you wanted it to be that same way on Friday night.
Yep.
And,
yep,
you know, there's a couple of tournaments that I've been involved with where I've done the lanes and you've helped, you know, in the background. You didn't want any, you know, your name out there, and you made some suggestions and it worked. And I'm not saying that surprisingly. It's just that we would have never thought of it. And you made some suggestions, and it's like, what was the highest scoring TV show? Erie?
Yes.
Is that still the record?
Yeah, Bob Arn. He went crazy today.
Yeah, I was almost thinking that might have been the one you were going to say, but I see what you're saying with the World Open. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, we weren't really out there to produce scores. We could, if you had to, you could put a whole lot of oil in the middle and make it stupid, but we tried not to do that unless the house insisted on it. A lot of bowling centers would put up $40,000 to bring the pros in there, give away
right,
all their league play all week, and they wanted to promote the house. So they kind of put the pressure on us to create scores. You know, we used to tell them, well, you know, you give us a good surface and we'll have good scores.
Right.
But you can't really paint a car that's been in a head-on collision, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. That's actually good. So now let's go the opposite. What was the hardest surface? And you can name a center, or you can just talk about, you know, a specific type of surface.
Yeah, well, you know, in the 80s when lanes – basically, there was a boom in the 50s, and by the 80s, most of these bowling centers were wearing out, and they didn't want to go through a whole big deal of remodeling and putting in brand new lanes. So there was a company that put out a cover-up, an overlap, something called Guardian. It was similar to plastic. You laid it over the top. Well, it was a good idea in the boardroom, but as soon as you put it on the lane and you had the 16-pound bowling balls in it, it started bubbling up, and you'd hear the ball splat when it went in it. The ball would hook at your toe, and it was the stupidest thing. I don't care where it was. You couldn't get any scores out of it. You couldn't get any good play out of it. And there was a couple of houses that we had to take the lanes out of play before the tournament even started. So we'd say it's a 40-lane house, but we're only going to use 32 of them this week because there are eight that are just impossible, and we don't want to embarrass the pros by having them shoot 120 and be happy about it. But the Guardian surface, fortunately, they don't use it anymore.
You know, it's funny because we bowled, and I won't name the center or the tournament, but I remember we bowled and they had just pulled that. A squad, I think one guy shot over, two guys shot over, whatever, and then B squad came around and just ran them over to where first off our squad was 24th or 25th. And I remember you talking about it, about how much the oil moved on it and how much they literally changed. I always talk about it's like bowling on mud. The ball would just bog down so much in the front part of the lane that it was just, you know, I don't even know if anybody ever really got good at competing on that.
No.
You know? All right, now, what years were you regional director?
I was the regional director in the West from 82 to the fall of 88.
And if you were going to, who were, out of the guys that competed, and I was one of them, so let's just leave that one alone, but who were your top five guys that competed in our region at that time?
You know what? The Western region had a lot of strong players. We had about 20 tournaments a year, basically one every 2 to 3 weeks. You know, there was a lot of the better righties that were from the Western region that bowled a couple. Then they went back out on a tour. They went back and forth. Some of the great righties bowled both were like Randy Peterson and Frank Ellenberg and Mark Baker and Dave Frame and Jay Robinson. And there were many others that only bowled part-time in our region. But the guys that pretty much bowled almost every week during the 80s out there were the top five in my mind were Larry Gray, Ross Packard, Jim Tilton, Dennis Horan, and a fellow that we lost a little bit. He was a little bit too young to go, but he left us, and that was Bill Robin.
Yeah, Billy Robin, yeah. That's a good one because those are five guys that I knew pretty well and competed against. And, yeah, Billy did, yeah. I remember that's a tough one right there. So
yeah, it sure was, Forbes.
If I was going to ask you one last question, if I was doing your eulogy, other than I know what you want on your tombstone, what would you want be what would you want to be remembered for?
Oh, boy. You know, I'll tell you the truth. I've been very fortunate to be around some of the greatest athletes in the world, and that's the bowlers. Anybody that says they're not athletes is stupid because the bowlers, top players are great athletes, and I always wanted to be involved in sports, so I was very fortunate there, and I came along at the right time, and I took on a job with my friend Sam Baca that, without question, is the most controversial area in all of sports, lane conditions, because you can't see it. It's invisible. No matter what you do, you're going to hear some kind of complaints, so you have to have a good mental game to put up with all that kind of stuff, just like the good bowlers have to be. And you know what? We took on this challenging, unknown thing of lane conditioning, trying to make them fair for the pros. And after about 800 tournaments, I was recognized as doing a good job, and I got put into the PPA Hall of Fame. And, you know, that's all that can be said. There's nothing greater than that honor. And if I can be remembered for taking on this and looking at it as a scientific thing and making my adult livelihood out of it, I'm very proud of it. Thanks.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, I mean, as you said previously, you know, we've been friends for a long time. And, you know, I look at the friends that we've been able to acquire over the years and whatnot, and you are by far one of my closest. And that's, you know, I appreciate everything you've done for the game, and I appreciate everything you've done for me. So let's not get too sappy here because, you know.
yeah, for sure. Thank God we're out of time. I'm starting to tear up, but anyway,
well,
Rick.
It's back to you. It's your show now.
All right, Bards. Well, I appreciate it. The old clock and all tells me we are out of time, and I really appreciate you being back with us again, and I'm going to have you on here often because you talk about history, you talk about the growth of the game, and you're fully involved in it. And I appreciate your experience and also for taking the time to be here with us, and I hope to see you again soon, somewhere down the road.
That's a definite, and I hope the people that are listening really enjoy this because you have a wealth of knowledge, and just telling the little stories are always the funnest whenever we're around and getting a chance to BS and whatnot. So thank you for having me on again, and have a good holiday. And, yes, we will see each other soon.
Yeah, we're going to see each other in a month, less than a month, down at the Vacaville for that next tournament that's going on with the Honda Vacaville. It's a $10,000 first place, and I know you're going to be involved down there. Your buddy Robbie, he needs you to do all that hard work that you do. And in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have a show, and I'm going to announce a book that's coming out that I wrote about all the Hall of Famers, so that'll be on the agenda coming up. But Phantom fans, that's going to wrap up another show this week, and hope that you all enjoyed it. Enjoyed hearing from Rick Hamlin. And we look forward to talking to all of you again next week. We'll have yet another interesting guest to talk to. In closing, we sincerely want to thank our sponsors, Elitebowling.com, Storm Bowling Products, and Brad Hedelman for their continued support of our show. We appreciate all that they do to keep us coming back to you each and every week. So for Phantom Radio, this is the Phantom.